welcome to episode 409 of Retro Encounter, RPG Fans' weekly podcast of many topics. I'm Mike Solosi, and listeners, today I'm bringing this all the way back to where it all began for me, because today's episode is about Final Fantasy IV, and that was my first RPG, which I played at a sleepover many, many years ago. But before I tell you stories of my youth, let's introduce the rest of the panel, starting with Zach Wilkerson.
Hello.
Also, Lucas Green.
Hello.
And Alex Frenichek.
Hello.
Alex, Lucas, Zach. The four of us are all, I don't know, around the same age. We're in our 30s. Maybe, I'm sorry if I'm putting words in your mouth, but there was a certain reverence that RPG fans had for Squaresoft games of the 1990s. They were the formative RPGs for many, many people. And maybe I'm just only speaking to my own experience, because that's definitely true for me. I played Final Fantasy IV for the first time at a friend's sleepover when I think I was 7 or 8, which would have been 1993 or 94. And I was entranced by it. I ended up seeking out RPGs, even though I didn't have a Super Nintendo at the time. I rented Dragon Warrior and bought up Final Fantasy I and couldn't finish either of them. But this was the game that kicked off my RPG fandom, as it were. So maybe I have a very positive, rosy, nostalgic view of Final Fantasy IV that some share, and some maybe will take a more appropriately jaded view. I mean, I've gone into it a little bit. Let's talk about how far back we go with Final Fantasy IV, even if at the time you thought it was Final Fantasy II, as I did. You first, Zach.
So my story is not too dissimilar from yours. It wasn't my first RPG. Like, I had played NES RPGs growing up, and I'd even beaten a few. But Final Fantasy IV, I think it's what solidified like RPGs as like my genre. Like, I remember like watching my grandparents play it and just being like, oh my gosh, look at these graphics and this music and just like sort of the drama of it. And it was like it was the reason that I wanted a Super Nintendo. And so it's a game that I feel similarly about. Like, it, every time I start it up, I know I'm going to finish it unless it's the DS version. And it just goes down easy. And I think it's just because everything about it, like, people talk about comfort games, and for me, Final Fantasy IV is a comfort game.
It was a cozy playthrough this time around for me as well. And this wasn't the only game that made me get a Super Nintendo, but a couple years after playing Final Fantasy IV, and then also seeing Chrono Trigger, Secret of Mana, Final Fantasy VI, and others at friends' houses before having them for myself or renting them for myself, it was the Squaresoft suite of RPGs that made me want to get my own Super Nintendo and get those for myself. Because before really playing Final Fantasy IV, my NES was a Mario, Zelda, Duck Hunt, and Mega Man machine. But Lucas, you go further back than FF4 than even I do. What's your history with Final Fantasy IV?
Yeah, it was about the same as yours, except it wasn't my first RPG. I had played a few others. I actually kind of missed it and played Final Fantasy VI before it. But once I kind of fell in love with that series, I went back. It was when I rented a couple times, but I didn't actually finish it until I entered my emulation phase in college. But then I devoured it, and at this point, I've pretty much played through every version of it, which I think we'll touch on later.
Oh, so you were one of the lucky few with a Wonderswan color out there.
Okay, I didn't do that. But, you know, all the Nintendo versions and handheld versions and PSP, and I've also played a couple ROM hacks for it, and played a lot of the randomizer. So it's easily the Final Fantasy game I've put the most time into.
Now, that's interesting. I don't think this is the Final Fantasy game I've put the most time into, because some Final Fantasy games are just longer, and I've grinded more in those, and I'm side-eyeing Final Fantasy Tactics real hard right now. But
That's fair.
I think Final Fantasy IV is the Final Fantasy game I've beaten the most times, because every time a new damn version comes out, I get it and I play it again, and that's added up, and maybe I've played one or two of those versions more than once. So that's added to something like 7 or 8 playthroughs minimum, maybe more than that. So Again, I don't. It's not my favorite Final Fantasy. I'm not even sure it's in my top three. Actually, well, I'll say it. It's definitely not in my top three, but I still enjoy it, and I think it's the one I've played the most number of times.
That might be a better, a more accurate way to put it. Yeah, I might have put more hours into some other ones, but there's not a lot of them that I've replayed this many times. And I mean, especially keeping in mind things like, you know, getting into challenge ROM hacks and randomizers, there's a lot of replayability there and a lot of extra grinding. So,
yeah, Zach, how does your playthrough of Final Fantasy IV stack up against how much time you've put into Final Fantasy XIV, say?
Oh, I mean, it's not, I've spent thousands of hours on 14, and I've certainly played through Final Fantasy IV, I don't know, probably a dozen times, but stack all those dozen times on top of each other and maybe multiply that by 100, and then that would give me 14 play time.
All right. Well, Alex, I'm not going to ask how many times you've beaten FF4, but how far back do you go with it?
Pretty much as far back as you can go. Basically, was exposed to this game before I could even understand how a controller worked, because I'm close to 30, a couple months, and I'm going to hit that decade of my life. But
I feel so old. I just turned 38.
So actually, you're the same age as my oldest brother, which is actually how I first experienced Final Fantasy IV. Basically, I used to just watch him play RPGs. RPGs were his favorite genre. Final Fantasy were his favorite RPGs. So my mom used to like literally avoid hiring a babysitter just by seating me in front of my brother playing RPGs. And I was like, apparently, like just absolutely transfixed, even as like a 1-2-year-old, just watching these things. So I probably was watching Final Fantasy IV before I even had any idea what was going on. But once I was able to start like processing what was happening, I was just like, yeah, I was hit by that same sense of awe that you guys were describing, of just like, oh my God, like these characters are so cool and interesting, and the story is like so deep and complex. And of course, going back to it now, like that's not quite the case, but at the time it was mind blowing. And I mean, this game's still doing a lot of really clever things with its characters, with its storytelling. Even though like the nostalgic goggles are definitely present. But yeah, I love this game. It might still be my second favorite Final Fantasy after 6. I've played through it a couple times. And this is my first time playing it with the DS version, which has come with both a couple of nice benefits, things I appreciate, and a couple of things that have maybe fogged up those nostalgia glasses a bit, especially in terms of the graphics and whatnot.
We've mentioned this a couple times, like there's several versions of Final Fantasy IV, and that can affect your play experience quite heavily depending on which version you're playing. I mean, depending on whether you count certain things as a true other version or not, there's at least 7 or 8 Super Nintendo, PlayStation, a second Super Nintendo version called Easy Type, which changed some sprites and made it considerably easier. The North American Final Fantasy II on the Super Nintendo had some of the easy type graphics and changes, but was mostly the difficulty of the original version. The PlayStation 1 version was released as a separate game in Japan, but as a collection with Chrono Trigger in North America called Final Fantasy Chronicles. There was a Game Boy Advance version that added a bunch of extra post-game stuff, including the ability to swap in characters that left your party at different parts of the game, so you get end game equipment for Edward and Sid and all those guys and gals. Before that, there was a WonderSwan color version that I think I joked about earlier this episode, that there was Square had a dalliance with the WonderSwan color back in the day. I think there was a way to connect a WonderSwan color to your PlayStation to get some FF8 items or something.
I don't even know what a WonderSwan color is, honestly.
But then after that GBA version was the DS version, which Alex is playing, which is a fully built from the ground up 3D version of Final Fantasy IV, that's mostly true to the original in content. Doesn't have any of the post-game GBA changes, but there's voice acting, 3D visuals, reworked audio.
Bad voice acting.
and some gameplay changes that maybe we'll talk about later. And then the PlayStation portable version was mostly the GBA version, but with crisper visuals and a tiny bit of extra content on top of the GBA version's extra content. For a while, I you know what, maybe that still is my favorite version of FF4. I'm not sure. I'm not prepared to do that exercise right now.
Either that or the Pixel Remaster. The orchestrated music in the Pixel Remaster is something special.
Yeah, but after that PSP version, there were there was a direct download Wii version and a mobile version that you really can't get legally anymore. And then, as Lucas alluded to, the Pixel Remasters, which came out in 2022 on PC, then 2023 on console. And then those have a visual overhaul, newly orchestrated, reworked music that is mostly excellent, and a few quality of life changes, like being able to adjust experience and encounter rate. And that's how I played the game. They went on sale on Switch like right after we decided to play FF4, which I considered a sign from the gaming gods. So I immediately loaded that thing on my Switch and really cruised through the game, abusing that no encounter rate option, like I was playing Bravely Default back in 2015. Good times. I think that Alex and I have both mentioned it now. Zach, what version of FF4 are you playing?
The Pixel Remaster version as well on Switch.
Nice. And Lucas, how about you?
Pixel Remaster on Steam.
All right. So, yeah, how about that Pixel Remaster? I know we've talked about it on Random Encounter a little bit, and there was even a dedicated Rhythm Encounter episode about the music tracks in these recent Pixel Remasters. But, yeah, these new versions of Final Fantasy 1 through 6, I've only played FF4 so far, but they're pretty dope, and I had so much fun, I'm considering playing the other five, even maybe later this year.
I think I do prefer the PSP version. Just I think its balancing is a little bit better. But in terms of like a game that I don't really need to replay in its like fullest form, it's very convenient just to be able to turn off encounters very quickly, turn my EXP up to like x4, get in 3 battles, and then, you know, run through a dungeon. And so that's really nice for me. And the music is great. You know, people overuse the term, like it sounds like what you remember, but it totally does. I think it's a great version of the game, even if I think that it makes it perhaps even easier than the original, which is saying something. I think the PSP version's better on that front.
I'm still not sure if I like the PSP or Pixel Remaster version more, because the extra content in the GBA and PSP version, while unnecessary, is still mostly fun, and you can get into real crazy shenanigans like Edward's new harps and Rydia's mist ring and stuff. But even though the new post-game dungeons are not very well designed, but they at least give you more stuff to do. But I also don't love some of the visual changes in Pixel Remaster. The enemy art looks awesome, but the character art looks not as ugly and smoothed out as the mobile version, but still, I don't know. It doesn't look as crisp as those PSP rework sprites that I love.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I guess I was sitting far enough away from my TV that I didn't notice it so much. But yeah, I mean, I think that the look of the PSP one is so striking, and it feels kind of unique. And especially now with like all the Pixel Remasters kind of looking the same to some degree, like it, except for 6, maybe, I do think there is something to it having a unique look that this one obviously doesn't have.
All right, the one thing graphically for me that the Pixel Remaster didn't quite hit was some of the fixes they did to the Mode 7 like world map, especially some of the cutscenes with the airships just looked really awkward, and that kind of reminded me of like what you were saying with the, you know, the mobile versions, or like the smoothing or the stretching that you get. Something they did something with it, I'm not sure what. It didn't quite work for me, but that's a pretty minor complaint, all things considered.
Well, now that we know what versions we're playing, the rest of this doesn't matter, because all of those are still the same FF4 story that we know and love. And this was, at least to me, from my perspective at the time, sort of kicked off a rather excellent run that Square had on the Super Nintendo. This was one of the last games that Square released where they were still calling themselves Square. I mean, the company has always been just Square from the beginning until the merger with Enix to become Square Enix in 2003. But Final Fantasy 2/4 was one of the last games where they had Square on the box instead of Squaresoft, which became their sort of internationally marketed name starting in late 1991 or early 1992. But yeah, Final Fantasy IV, which, I mean, I guess I've already said it, was called Final Fantasy II in North America at first, and Final Fantasy VI was called Final Fantasy III in North America at first, until there was a bit of a market correction, and from Final Fantasy VII onward, they were all appropriately numbered. Final Fantasy IV begins with a sort of dramatic opening scene. You have this Imperial March sort of music, and Cecil the Dark Knight is leading a group of air warships called the Red Wings, and you're basically bullying a somewhat pastoral community of mages, the city of Mizidia, into taking their water crystal. And the crystals are four sort of objects of power held by four of the kingdoms of this world. And Baron, which does not have a crystal of their own, seems to be on an agenda to take the other four nations' crystals. And this does not sit very well with Cecil. He's sort of doubted, he thinks they were unfair to the Mizidians. He's not sure why they had to have a show of force like that. But when he speaks to the king and asks why he had to do that, the king strips him of his command and sends him on a mission to a sort of a boondock village called Mist. And in these early scenes, you see Cecil interact with several people in the castle. The King of Baron is a father figure to him, but has had a change of attitude recently. His best friend is a knight, is a dragon knight or dragoon named Kane. He has a girlfriend named Rosa and a buddy named Sid, who is the airship engineer and creator of the Red Wings. Cecil seems well-liked, but he's also a little bit moody. He feels bad about what happened, but he's a dark knight that draws his strength from anger and inner darkness. So he's feeling conflicted about what happened in Mizidia. And then he leaves to go on this mission to Mist. Kane accompanies him. When you reach Mist Village, you have to fight a mist dragon that's guarding the village entrance at the end of a cave. A young girl named Rydia is standing over her dead mother, because by killing the mist dragon, you killed the dragon summoner, which was Rydia's mother. So Rydia already hates Cecil and Kane, but then hates them even more when the package that Cecil was instructed to deliver explodes and releases bomb monsters, burning the village to the ground. So the game, in the first 20 or 30 minutes, there you have this cool, edgy Dark Knight Cecil, but he has a bunch of friends, he's uncertain about his convictions, and he destroys a village and orphans a young girl. Excuse me, a pretty dramatic, action-packed opening for a 1991 game. And everything from that Red Wings opening music to the cave music in the Cave to Mist, and to like your first meeting with Rydia, that's very indelible to me. When I was playing this last month for the first time in many, many years, I really, really felt the nostalgia hammer hard. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how long it's been since any of you guys played the Final Fantasy IV, but it really sent me back to being a kid at a sleepover in 1993 again. So what do we think of this opening hour or so of FF4? A lot's going on at once, even though this is a game fairly early in the history of RPG video games.
I mean, I think especially the first 15 minutes are just really remarkably striking. Like that image of Cecil on the airship and the music, it's so striking. And then as he and Kane are walking out, and like that, you know, Final Fantasy main theme starts, and you get that little crawl, Final Fantasy I style, it just feels like, I don't want to say quintessentially Final Fantasy, but I think in a lot of ways, like, it becomes like sort of a defining feature of what the series is. I don't want to get into that conversation, right? But like, when I think of Final Fantasy, that's what I think of. And I think a lot of people think of that too, which is why they are unhappy with the direction that maybe the series has taken. And so I think that it gets me every time. And I'm like, oh, this is so good. And there's just so much melodrama that it's exciting. And especially as a kid, I just thought it was incredible.
Yeah, I think you're right in calling it quintessentially Final Fantasy, because even though Final Fantasies 1 to 3, like, each have like interesting things about them, like Final Fantasy 4 is really when the series like became itself fully, and a lot of that has to do with just like the cinematic set pieces that the games start becoming interesting and exploring. And the opening of this game is like still one of the most memorable openings of any of the games, I think, because it not only because it's so well paced, like the entirety of this game kind of ends up being, but because it, I mean, like Cecil, it might be like, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, of course, but maybe the first like anti-hero protagonist in like any RPG or video game that I can think of, at least, like the fact that you're seeing somebody essentially committing war crimes, and then you're just like, oh yeah, you are this character now. It's like really interesting, like still today, I think. The fact that you have like this best friend who's kind of seems to be like a little less questioning, like immediately sets up like an interesting friendship / rivalry between the two, and I think they're both really great characters. And yeah, I mean, thinking back to it, I love these characters, and like they look kind of menacing in their armor, and it's just like a really striking way of opening a game, especially at the time. But I will say, with the DS version, as soon as these two characters opened their mouths and the voice acting kicked in, that's when my nostalgia glasses started fogging up a bit, because all the ways that my imagination filled in the characterizations at the time that I played the game before, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, what have you, that was kind of destroyed by just hearing the voice actor that they chose for this game. Like, Cecil just sounds so whiny. And
I don't have a perfect memory of the voice acting in FF4 DS, but I do remember Kane was real gravelly.
So gravelly. Oh,
and,
my God.
And Cecil was, I guess whining, but like he was emoting his self-doubt in a way that that didn't seem right to me.
Yeah, there's so much you could project onto Cecil when all you're seeing is that like pixelated figure and like basically a helmet. You don't even see his face for like the first couple hours of the game, but his first 3D model, for some reason you can see his face in cutscenes, and none of it just felt very right to me. But you know, that's just a criticism for this version, and I still think the intro hit hard and was fantastic to experience again.
I want to go back to something Zach mentioned, and I know you said specifically you didn't want to go into it, but I just want to make a comment regarding that, which is this: the idea of this being a quintessential Final Fantasy, and the idea that some people don't like the direction it's going because of that. Part of what makes this quintessential to me is Square pushing the edge of what was possible at the time, utilizing what was at the time very new technology and doing new things. And like, I mean, even the idea of having these very emotive, very complex characters in a game was new at the time. And I think that a lot of people, when they're complaining about the direction it's going, aren't thinking about the fact that this was new back then and it's old now. A lot of what Square has always been about is pushing the limits with what they could do.
Yeah, I think that one way that Final Fantasy has differentiated itself from other series that you'd call its contemporaries, like the Dragon Quests of the world, is that every Final Fantasy tries to do something wildly different from any other game in its own series. They'll share iconography like Jobs and Bahamut. I think every character in Final Fantasy IV is a representation of a Final Fantasy III job, except for maybe Kane, Cid, and one late game character.
There are dragoons in Final Fantasy III.
Oh, there's FF3. I know there was a Dark Knight in FF3.
And sages.
And I knew Sage was. I was thinking of Lunarian, but but yeah, I guess other than Lunarian and Engineer, all of them are an FF3 job. But like every Final Fantasy game does something wildly different from the ones before it, to one degree, especially when Final Fantasy was getting very modern. People that whose like favorite Final Fantasy is somewhere in the 4 to 9 range was probably a little bewildered and disappointed by what, say, Final Fantasy 11, 12, or 13 did. We could have a long conversation about fandom and perception and what Final Fantasy is that I'm frankly not interested in having. I still think the best Final Fantasy game of the 20th century is, I'm sorry, of the 21st century is Final Fantasy 14 by a large margin. But the some people don't even think of that as a main series Final Fantasy game because it's an MMO. We're not going to have that conversation now, but I think that FF4 did a lot of things that are just crucial to what the series became, especially for how character driven it was, how mm-hmm. there was a character angst character redemptive arcs. The guy from FF2 NES doesn't count. a lot of sort of what Final Fantasy became, I think you can find the seeds of that in Final Fantasy IV. But I'm moving the story on a little bit. Cecil takes Rydia to a village called Kaipo. He finds his girlfriend Rosa is also there because after Rosa heard that Cecil might have disappeared in an explosion, she went out to find him but caught a desert disease. So searching for a cure for Rosa, Rydia decides to trust Cecil after he protects her from monsters. You meet Sage Tella, who's a powerful magic user, but he's quite elderly, so he has pitifully low MP that gets eclipsed by Rydia, by like 6-year-old Rydia's MP quite soon. You fight a sort of giant octopus in a waterfall cave together, and then as you're approaching the desert kingdom Damsian, you see the Red Wings, Cecil's former command of airships, completely annihilate Damsian Castle. And you go in there, Tella sees his daughter, Anna, like dying on the ground in the arms of her boyfriend, Edward, the Prince of Damsian. And in a fit of rage, Tella attacks Edward, calls him a spoony bard, which is became a meme slash memory of Final Fantasy fans forevermore after that. I don't know what it is in the original Japanese, and I frankly don't care that he's a spoony bard. And then Tella leaves the party. Edward joins the party. He tells you where you can find an item that will cure Rosa. You use his cool hovercraft to go to another cave to find that item. And then you head all the way back to Kaipo. And pretty soon your party is Cecil the Dark Knight, Rydia the Summoner, Rosa the White Mage, and Edward the Bard. That's the next hour or two of Final Fantasy IV. And it sounded fast, but I did fast forward through some dungeon exploration, plenty of random battles and experience, and a non-trivial amount of grinding. But I didn't have to deal with any of that because I had random encounters off the entire time. It was great.
Oh. It's beautiful.
It's so wonderful.
I'm not sure how far we're going to get, but like that was great a lot of the places, but oh my goodness, Troia, the Trojan Cave, not having to deal with that.
Oh,
garbage.
The Magnet Cave, yeah.
Oh, I was that was a godsend.
And we're not going to talk about that today, but the Sealed Cave in the second part of the game where you fight a bunch of doors that attack you.
Yeah.
Not having to deal with random encounters for that was awesome.
Or the sections where there's damage tiles.
That's true. There's a couple caves that are loaded with damage tiles, and you don't have to. You can ignore them until you get to a safe space later, unless there's a monster in a box, in which case you could have a very, very unwelcome game over.
Yeah.
But fortunately, when that happened to me, an autosave took me right to the beginning of the dungeon, so I didn't lose too much sleep over that. But Final Fantasy IV does have random battles in almost every version, and in every version, but only one version lets you turn them off. And I would say the grind is non-trivial. It'll get in the way in some caves where maybe you'll run out of MP or healing resources a little too fast. But I don't think any of the dungeons are too oppressive or overlong until maybe the very, very end of the game. But I mean, no, I didn't have to worry about that because I had random encounters turned off all the time.
Yeah, no, I think that one of the things that makes this game work well in general is the dungeon design. And I think that, you know, accepting the DS version, because I didn't get past the Tower of Babel in that version, I think, because I just got tired of it. But I think that the game is balanced around that. And at least the encounter rate, when I had it turned on briefly in the Pixel Remaster version, felt reasonable. But yeah, I just think that everything is relatively straightforward with just enough secrets off to the side to make it enjoyable to engage with. And that's been true since, you know, the original version. So I think the dungeon design in this game is a real boon, especially compared to the game it comes after, which has some absurd dungeons.
Well, I mean, everything moves at a pretty good pace, and except for the hovercraft in the Pixel Remaster. That thing just drags.
Well, I'm very happy for you guys that you get to just cruise through this game, just enjoying the story,
meeting
the characters.
Just grab every item in the cave with the encounters turned off, and then if your level's a little low, you can turn experience way up and gain 3 levels in one fight. Oh, it's just the best. You got to do this.
Yeah, out. Sounds very nice, and I'm sure I will one day, and I'll have a great time with it. But as somebody who actually is playing the game.
hey, this is the podcast where we actually play the games we talk about on RPG Fan.
I know. I'm playing the DS version, which is notoriously considered probably the hardest version. I think it actually is supposed to be emulating the original Japanese release in difficulty, which the game was like nerfed in difficulty for the North America release.
There was an easy type Japanese release. And then the North American version sort of wasn't exactly a port of the easy type. It was original, but with some easy type changes. Strange looking at the different versions of FF4 over the years. But the original Japanese version, which is preserved in the PS1 version, was considered the hardest until the DS came around.
Right. And yeah, it has been tough, especially like hitting some bosses. Barbariccia comes to mind, has been like kind of hard and has called for a bit of grinding for sure. But I will say I've had a good time with it, just like kind of meeting every random battle I hit, even having like a bit of struggle against like regular mobs has been actually kind of fun. In its own way, unless I die and lose a bunch of progress, in which it immediately becomes very unfun. But I have been enjoying the challenge for the most part, and the challenge is kind of offset by the augment system, which is unique to the 3D version, which basically makes it that you can get these augments, which are special, like either passive abilities or active abilities. For the party members, like the first one you get automatically is just like an auto potion ability that if you assign that to your character's move list, and you can like mix and match your move list so you can take off like moves that a character would be fixed to their kit otherwise and just customize it a little bit. That's been like a cool thing to experiment around with. It would be a lot cooler if it was actually explained well by the game. But it's definitely not, and I didn't really know what I was doing at first, which turned out that I actually made it that I couldn't get some very useful augments, such as dual cast, which has been a shame. But now that I got the hang of it and I was able to get a couple of different ones, it adds a really cool customizability to the game systems that the original and I think pretty much every other version just didn't really have, that you can actually... add some customization to your kits, come up with some builds, things like that. So that's been cool, and I'm a little scared of where the difficulty is going to take me, but for now, been having a pretty good time with it. So that's my 2 cents reporting in from the DS version.
I played the DS version once around when it came out, and I know enough not to want to go back to that version anymore. I didn't own the Pixel Remasters when we decided to play FF4 last month, but then they went on sale, and I jumped at the sale. I was probably going to play the GBA version, but on an analog pocket to see how it to see how that machine scales it up. But the DS version, the augment stuff is interesting, but you sort of have to know how the system works to take advantage of it. And it's, as you said, it's underexplained and easy to make a mistake or lock yourself out of its more powerful abilities. And that I don't remember exactly what abilities I used the most, but I do remember being like similarly not getting dual cast and some other stuff that sounded cool, mm-hmm. but I never had the opportunity to use.
Yeah, and just to like vent about like one particularly like arbitrary one, and like you basically like need a guide if you want to get like most of the augments, which is just bad design in my opinion. Like if there were like NPCs that could give you like hints towards where to pursue augments, I'd like the system a lot better. But like for example, after you kill Barbaricia after you kill Barbaricia, you have to actually go back to the Magnet Cave, go all the way down back to the Crystal Room where you fought the Dark Elf, and there will be the Whirlwind augment there. Nothing in the game tells you that. You just have to somehow know or somehow have a desire to go through the Magnet Cave again. So in that sense, the system kind of sucks. But if you have a guide, you can actually get the augments and have some fun with it.
And Zach and I were just mentioning how one place we were glad to be able to turn off random encounters is the Magnet Cave. Yep. So replaying that in its original version doesn't sound like fun at all. But I mean, in my defense for playing Final Fantasy IV in the most gameplay avoidant way possible, this is at least the 8th time I've played this game, maybe more than 10. So I feel like I'm allowed to just cruise through it to remember all the plot points and how it feels and talk about it on the podcast. But also I'm enjoying this breezy way of playing it so much that I kind of want to maybe replay all 5 other Pixel remasters. Because again, I've played these Final Fantasy games most of the time. And maybe you've noticed this or listeners noticed this. I'm very rarely on Final Fantasy games for retro encounter. And it's because in the 90s and early 2000s, I mean, I was on Final Fantasy forums. I was making Final Fantasy guides. I was replaying these games over and over. When I joined RPG Fan and I co-founded the Retro Encounter podcast, I wasn't on Final Fantasy Tactics episodes early on because that was a game that I thought I'd played that game too much and would just talk over everybody else. And I mean, I eventually had a career of talking over everybody else in podcasts anyway. But because I played these games so much, they almost feel played out to me. I rarely do Final Fantasy episodes. I was on Final Fantasy X episodes because that was a game I sort of didn't like before and then decided to give it a second chance. I did some Final Fantasy 13 episodes because that's one of the few Final Fantasy games I hadn't played. But I avoided the FF5 and FF6 and FF12 episodes when they happened. But with Final Fantasy IV, it's like, you know, this was my first RPG. I haven't played FF4 in a long time. Let's do it. And I'm having so much fun that, especially playing it in this random encounters off experience level adjustable way, that I kind of want to play every Final Fantasy game like this now. But I'm also a big Bravely Default fan, so I don't. Maybe this is just exactly hitting my tastes and preferences with like 60 points on a dartboard. But back to the story. After you get the Spoony Bard moment and you save Rosa, you go through a mountain pass towards the city of Fabul to warn them that Baron might be coming for their wind crystal. You meet Yang the monk. I always thought Yang was sort of a super cool character. He was maybe my first time encountering a martial arts kind of character in a video game. Like, I mean, I never played karateka or kung fu or anything, but like this seemed like a Street Fighter character in a Final Fantasy game, which I don't know. I always sort of thought Yang was cool. And when the GBA version brought back all of the departed characters, like the one I was most excited to get endgame stuff for was Yang by a large margin. I mean, that's my Yang fandom appreciation station. But you accompany Yang to Fabul, you warn the king, Baron does in fact attack, You it doesn't go very well for you, but the final opponent before Baron takes the Wind Crystal is none other than Kane. Kane has remained loyal to Baron. He seems sort of grim and eager to defeat Cecil, which shocking to Cecil, since he and Kane are best friends. And Kane even makes a comment to Rosa that he's a better man than Cecil ever was. And so this is maybe the first of multiple Kane betrayals in Final Fantasy IV. But after that moment, you decide to take a ship to I forget the exact circumstances. Are you trying to go to
Baron?
Yeah, trying to go back to Baron.
You're trying to go back to Baron, right? I wasn't sure if you were trying to go to Troia yet or just Baron. Okay, so you take a ship back to Baron, but you're attacked by the sea monster Leviathan on the way, and Cecil ends up shipwrecked or washed ashore near Mizidia, the town he attacked as the leader of the Red Wings at the very beginning of the game. And he's received very negatively in Mizidia. Everyone hates him for extremely fair reasons. You can accidentally get turned into a frog or a pig or both. But the Elder of Mizidia decides to give you a chance if you can shed your inner darkness at a special sacred place called Mount Ordeals. Then maybe he'll be able to help you. So he gives you he lends you two apprentice mages, Palum and Porum, to accompany you up Mount Ordeals. And Cecil's not really totally sure what's going on. He doesn't know what you mean by having his inner darkness depart. On Mount Ordeals, you meet Tella the Sage again, who's looking for an ancient black magic spell that will be able to allow him to take revenge on his daughter's killers. And so with Palum, Porum, and Tella, you get to the top of Mount Ordeals, fight a monster named Scarmilione, or Mylon, if you're playing the original Super Nintendo translation. Where they couldn't fit, the names of the gatekeepers of hell from Dante's Inferno into their limited number of character names, or limited number of character spaces in each name. But after Scarmilione is done, you hear a mysterious voice in this Hall of Mirrors. Cecil transforms. As he makes a character transformation, he also makes a physical transformation. And you are no longer a Dark Knight, but a level 1 paladin. And you have to challenge your inner darkness literally by fighting a dark mirror version of yourself, which you defeat by just guarding or using items or at least not attacking for a few turns in a row. And then now you're Paladin Cecil. And that's now Final Fantasy IV truly begins, because, you can deal damage to undead enemies now. But I think this is one of the signature moments of the game,
mm-hmm.
Right up there with the opening. And again, the metaphor of someone who's burdened by darkness, like literally excising his own darkness to become a warrior of light is an incredibly clear metaphor. But also, I think one of the signature moments in the entire series. Let's talk about Paladin Cecil.
Yeah, I think this moment is still one of my favorite moments in any video game. I use it to teach narrative design to my students. I use multiple aspects of this game, actually. It's one of the games we play for that unit. But I just like the way everything is represented, like the whole fight against yourself, where you're essentially the best way to win the fight is actually to defend rather than attack. And of course, one of Paladin Cecil's main mechanics is the fact that he can cover for people. He can defend people, party members, and also like inflict damage. And he can also heal people. So the fact that Dark Knight Cecil is coming at you attacking, that's all you could do as Dark Knight Cecil after all. And you're just left there to defend and heal yourself, and then he vanishes. It's such a cool moment. And the fact that you then become, especially in the pixelated versions of the game, you just become a whole entirely new sprite. Your face is revealed. It's an immense moment of rebirth. You're back to level 1. It's really beautifully represented. It's one of the high points of this game. Just the way that it can combine these like narrative battle set pieces along with having like your level change, having your move list change. Like, it's using all these aspects of an RPG language to convey something about its characters. And that's the reason why I still really celebrate the story of this game. It's not because of the story itself. It's pretty melodramatic and silly after all. It's not because of the writing. It's very simplistic and surface level, but because it really tries to use RPG mechanics to amplify its storytelling. And this is the pinnacle of that for me.
That was absolutely beautifully said, and I don't have anything to add.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have much to add either. I mean, what's funny is, because we're talking about like how epic that moment is, and it totally is. And I agree with all the things you said, and I really like the way you talked about it in terms of just like game design, the way it gamifies its storytelling in a way that, again, was not something that I think we saw a ton of, at least in mainstream games up to that point. But what I find fascinating is like we've skipped over like all these other epic moments we could have talked about, which I understand for time reasons for not, but like it just gets to like what Final Fantasy IV is. Like, oh, Cain betrays you. That feels like such a quintessential moment in this game. And it just has so many of those things that the fact that this paladin moment rises to the top, I think speaks to its power. And it also speaks to the only good part of the after years, which
let's just say I was thrilled to podcast about Final Fantasy IV. There will not be an after years podcast on Retro Encounter.
That's still one I haven't gotten around to playing, and I'm not sure if I ever will. But
the Cain story is pretty good. That's about it.
That's basically what I've heard. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we have glossed over a lot of big parts of Final Fantasy IV. Like, there's a moment where there's a wall of ice blocking your way forward, and Rydia has to cast a fire spell to break it down. Mm-hmm. But she hates fire because it was fire bombs that destroyed her village. But Rosa gently sort of like reassures Rydia and gives her the encouragement she needs, which, you know, shows both the character growth of Rydia, who's a small child that's had unthinkable tragedy already happen to her, but also just what a kind soul and nurturing presence Rosa is in those characters. And we've barely mentioned Rosa this episode, but she is like such a supportive girlfriend that it's she's one of the best white mages in Final Fantasy history. With, you know, I'm not going to apologize for anything. She's one of the best white mages in Final Fantasy history. Where we are in the story now, I mean, at first it almost feels like the game's punishing you. It's like, oh man, I'm going from level 15 all the way back to level 1. But that's, you know, sort of just piggybacking on what Alex was saying. This is a literal new beginning for Cecil, and it's gamified and shown in his stats and menus and everything. Everything that's a video gamey about Final Fantasy IV, the narrative and gameplay are intertwined in a way that's always, always interesting and only occasionally frustrating. and yeah, if you're finding the DS version frustrating, Alex, just turn this battle speed way down. You'll find the enemies won't be having quite as many turns if you do that.
Yeah, that was actually an amazing tip that I'll definitely be following through on.
But yeah, speaking of following through, I guess we should keep going. Palam and Porum tell you that we were supposed to guide you, Cecil, but really we were spying on you to see if you really were going to try and turn over a new leaf. But now we like you, so everything's good. And the Elder of Mizidia makes good on that. He gives you a very convenient teleportation room that takes you straight to Baron. And at Baron, you see Yang in a, I think it's the inn?
Yeah, it's like the bar behind the inn. Yeah,
that's right. But he seems to very, very suddenly, because this can't be longer than a few days of game time, he's become an officer for Baron. You fight Yang and some Baron soldiers in a battle. And then after you knock out Yang and he comes to, it reveals that he was under some kind of mind control. And so that suggests that, well, does that mean Cain was mind controlled too? Was the king mind controlled? What's going on? And I think they actually mentioned this earlier, but they reveal that sort of the person orchestrating all of the atrocities committed by Baron is a man named Golbez, who this was always strange to me. Like, Cecil has not heard of Golbez, but he Golbez replaces Cecil as the commander of the Red Wings. He's a very powerful sorcerer. We don't really know where Golbez came from, why he's in Baron, why Cecil has never heard of him, but he goes from being nothing to the most important person in Baron basically instantly in this video game. And I don't think the return to Baron is the first time you hear about Golbez, but he's a shadow presence for the first quarter or so of Final Fantasy IV. But am I missing anything? Like, or does he really seem to come out of nowhere?
Yeah, no, there's no explanation for where he comes from that I'm aware of. But he does. I think they talk about him visiting Damsien and Fabul, so both Edward and Yang reference him at least.
Right. I was pretty sure he was introduced earlier than Cecil becoming a paladin, but I didn't remember exactly when. But it does seem to like he sprung out of nowhere to suddenly become the most powerful man in the world. Maybe the After Years explores that in a way that I've forgotten, but I've also deliberately removed everything I remember about the After Years from my brain. But in Baron, Yang rejoins your party. You go through a sewer dungeon because this is an RPG. You have to have one of those, I guess. And get back into Baron Castle, and you have two boss fights in a row that I remember being really challenged by as a kid. But this is where, you know, Final Fantasy IV has some teachable boss battle moments. And you know, in many ways, I'm sort of glad Final Fantasy IV was my first RPG, because not only was it great by early 90s standards, but it really does teach you RPG mechanics and things that serve you well through a whole career of playing RPGs. The first boss you fight, Bagan, the captain of the guard and Baron, who you see briefly at the beginning of the game, he turns into a monster that is weak against fire and resists other elements, but also casts Reflect on himself and then reflects spells off of him, which, you know, that makes you can't use Porom's black magic as easily in this fight, but also sort of teaches you how the Reflect status works and how you can get around it and have spells like reflected off yourself to damage enemies. And other bosses and regular enemies later in the game will incorporate that tactic again. And then the boss fight you fight right after Bagan, is the king of Baron, who has been either kidnapped or deposed or something and replaced by another one of the four elemental fiends, Kanyatso of Water. And Kanyatso is a powerful water monster. He's weak against thunder, and the way to stop his giant tsunami attack is to wait until water is surrounding him, then have Tella or Porom hit him with a thunder spell. So, like, in the Bagan and Kanyatso battles, I really feel like they're teaching you or elemental weaknesses, or at least really hammering home how elemental weaknesses are and status effects like Reflect are sort of a key part of gameplay here. Whatever. Like, I remember struggling with them as a kid. I did not struggle with them this time around, but I feel like those are two boss battles that are very educational in their own way.
That's a good way to put it. Although, fun fact, Kanyatso is actually weak to ice until his water comes up, and then he's weak to lightning.
It's even more complicated than I remember.
It is.
I was just hitting him with LIT2 over and over.
Yeah, playing the DS version, I'm definitely feeling how like every boss fight is trying to teach me to use the full extent of whatever my party's kit is at that time, to try to like offset like the things that feel overpowered about it. And like I know if, for a later example, at least the fight against the doll in like the Dwarven castle, like will just like keep countering like basically any attack you do, and like basically one shot your party. Like I don't think I was underleveled at that time, but I was getting absolutely one shot, and I didn't even realize that Rosa has a white magic spell. I think it's called Hold, and if you cast that, it actually prevents enemies from counterattacking. And I had like multiple moments like that through playing the DS version that I don't remember having in previous versions, where it just like if I didn't quickly think of how to puzzle solve whatever the gimmick of that boss was, like I'd get wiped within like a couple of turns. So that's been an interesting slash slightly frustrating part of the DS version.
This is skipping far, far ahead, but can I give you one hint for the final boss of the game that was extremely valuable to me this time around?
You sure can.
The final boss of the game is vulnerable to slow.
Okay.
So you can cast slow on him, and he won't be hitting you with those all-hitting powerful magic attacks quite as often.
I will be certain to remember that.
Also, slow stacks in this game. You can cast it multiple times on the same enemy.
Oh my. I didn't know that, but that is some Shin Megami Tensei Nocturne nonsense.
It'd be nice if the game, like, kind of told you, like, any of these things, like, in some way or another. Like I feel like every, like, ability move just gets, like a six-word description that doesn't even really sum up what it can do.
I mean, this is a 1991 game. Gameplay transparency was not, let's say, at From Software levels back in 1991. But it is, I mean, sometimes it is frustratingly opaque, and especially for you, Alex, like, they really don't even properly explain all the new mechanics in the DS version.
Yeah, just because the DS version is, like, a new remake, like, that's less of an excuse here. So, yeah, I like the difficulty of it, but I think that some of the design choices, like, ends up hampering it more than it needed to be.
I will say with the originals, at least a lot of the mechanics are hidden, like all of the weird, like, agility manipulation stuff that I was talking about before we were starting, the attack multiplier and the way accuracy works with it.
That's right. The very first time I had to grind in the game was at the Tower of Zot, because at certain levels, you just can't hit Barbariccia at all.
There's, like, every weapon has, like, an accuracy rating, and the person in the center actually gets a slight boost to their accuracy, which, of course, the game does not tell you. And it still has the mechanic, like, Final Fantasy 1, where you start, like, getting multiple attacks, and it's based on your level and your strength score, which it also never says. So there's actually, like, certain strength score cutoffs where you'll get a sudden boost to attack.
Yeah, we only know this because we've had decades of people researching and sharing information on this game, and not because of, you know, actual accessible information in-game.
Yeah, no, I have spent way too much time watching speedruns of this game and playing the randomizer. So that is speedrun tech, not actual reasonable mechanics to get into playing the game. And you don't need to. The best part is you don't need to know any of that to enjoy the game.
But speaking of enjoying the game and unreasonable mechanics, Zach, how about that magnet cave? Because we're there. We made it.
Hey, it was fine for me this time.
Anyway, after this game, this is one part of the game I remember years ago struggling a little bit as to where to go next. What you have to do is go to the one part of the world you haven't visited, or let's say the largest part of the world you haven't visited, the nation of Troia. Speak to the eight sisters that are the shared ruling council of Troia. Learn that they have the Earth Crystal, but they're protected by the Earth Crystal's magic. You're sort of accosted by Kane in the Red Wings airship, and he says, "All right, we have Rosa kidnapped, and we'll trade her for the Earth Crystal, but you have to get it from Troia for us." You go to Troia, you talk to the sisters. You also meet Edward, who was injured from that shipwreck, but he gives you a twin harp when he learns that you're going to try and recover the Earth Crystal from the evil elf that stole it, who I think is a reference to the dark elf from FF1 from near the beginning of that game.
Certainly seems like it.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, I think even the boss art is similar, but I don't know, I didn't do the deep research on that one. And he resides in the Magnet Cave, which is magnetized because the elf's weakness is metallic weapons. So if you go in there, anyone that has heavy armor or a metal weapon equipped will be in the hold or paralyzed status for any fight at all. So your party here is, oh my god, I completely skipped over it. We were so in the weeds talking about Final Fantasy IV mechanics, I didn't say why Palom and Porom are gone.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's important.
Rewind a little bit. after the Cagnazzo boss fight, you're leaving Baron Castle, the walls start closing in on you as sort of a last gasp from Cagnazzo. And it looks like that your entire party is going to be crushed. But then Palom and Porom, who were, you know, these bratty children, a white mage and a black mage that had accompanied you for the last 2.5 dungeons or so, willingly turn into stone to stop the walls from closing in. And even when Tella tries to cast Ezana and restore them, it doesn't work. And especially because they're children, because they sort of, you know, had a noble sacrifice in such a dramatic fashion, and because there's, I don't know, something gruesome about being crushed by walls or turning into stone, that this is another one of those signature moments for me. Like Palom and Porom turning into stone is sort of shocking and heartbreaking, especially for a 91 game.
Yeah, I remember this really surprising me and flooring me as a kid. Yeah, just because like it does feel like kind of genuinely terrifying when the walls are just like boom, boom, the big sound effect as they're closing in. And then, yeah, just like the fact that these little kids that have been accompanying you along and have been like very happy-go-lucky and goofy just realize where this is leading and what they have to do. It's a great moment of maturity for them. Just overall character development, and it hurts as a sacrifice. And just the fact that you can like approach them afterwards and it pulls up your item screen. I just remember doing that and like trying all my different items, trying like gold hairpin, and then it's just like, this doesn't work because they turn to stone of their own will. And it's just like, oh my God, like very well done game. Very well done.
Yeah, I think this game has a lot of moments of sacrifice throughout it.
Oh yeah.
This one has always felt the most powerful to me by a pretty large margin, just because of who the characters were, like you said. I mean, even the fact that they started as like not that long ago, they were spying on you. They were your enemy. Mm. You know, you like Cecil attacked their village and they still are willing to make this sacrifice because they're seeing that that's what needs to be done. And it genuinely is one of my favorite moments in the entirety of the series, if not just the game.
Wow, Lucas's favorite moment is children dying. That's interesting, huh? Well, that's on record forever now.
That's recorded.
But I guess fast forward again, back to the Magnet Cave. Your party at this time is Cid, Tella, Yang, and Cecil. I think it's really, I mean, you can equip everyone so they don't have any metallic stuff on, but that means giving Cecil robes and a bow, sticking to a wooden hammer for Cid, or bow and arrow, I guess, avoiding things like mithril rings. And also, I think that there's a bit of a difficulty spike. The enemies in the Magnet Cave are kind of hard for that part of the game.
Oh, yeah.
This, again, I think this and the Sealed Cave and the Path to the Core, the final dungeon of the game, are the three places I was most glad to have encounters turned off in this game.
And fun fact, for the DS version, you can't even equip a bow on Cecil, so you just have to have this like piddly fire sword that does basically no damage. So Cecil is basically just your white mage throughout that dungeon, which is kind of interesting. It forces you to like explore that side of his kit, but it also does not help with the difficulty spike.
But you get sort of another moment of drama at the end of this fight, because the Dark Elf hates metallic weapons. Completely wipes you out with you unable to use metal weapons on him when you encounter him. But then Edgar, wrong Final Fantasy game, Edward starts playing the twin harp, and the identical twin harp that he gave you in Troia starts echoing Edward's playing, which disrupts the Dark Elf's spell and allows you to use metallic weapons again. Cecil brandages his sword, and then you kick the Dark Elf's ass, which, again, this is the ending to one of the more frustrating parts of Final Fantasy IV. or at least in my memory, one of the more frustrating parts, because I skipped most of it this time. But then now I actually did have to start playing the game again, because after you go back to Troia, talk to the ruling council of sisters again, and then leave the kingdom, you meet Kane, and he takes you to the next gameplay section, which is a sort of a mechanical steampunk cyberpunk tower, the Tower of Zot, one dungeon type that always felt a little out of place in this game. But you know, like Final Fantasy has always had a complicated relationship with technology. But yeah, the Tower of Zot, I ran into some struggling against the bosses here. I think I mentioned before my trouble with Barbariccia. But this is the first time I turned random encounters back on and grinded a little bit, because I was pitifully underleveled for this dungeon. But I made it through after a while. There's a boss fight against the Magus sisters that do some more reflecting magic shenanigans. One of the sisters can revive the other two. Two of them attack consistently, and one will cast Reflect, one will bounce powerful spells off the Reflect. So you have to basically, I mean, if you're struggling through this with no information in advance, you can get burned pretty easily by not attacking the healing one first, and she will revive her sisters. But whatever, I played this game so many times, I didn't have to worry about any of that. I just knew which one to attack first.
You can also silence at least one of them, which,
oh, that'll help a little bit.
It helped, yeah, big time.
If you can silence the one that casts fire too, then, or Fira, I mean, using later terminology, that's probably really good.
That was the one. And just another fun fact, I think the narrative designers realized how off the very sci-fi technological feel of the Tower of Zot was in the original. So they actually completely changed the aesthetic of it for the DS one. It looks kind of more like a Victorian palace, or antiquated kind of vibes to it. It was interesting. And I actually completely forgot what it looked like before I looked it up. Now I'm just like, wow, they completely changed what this dungeon looks like.
I didn't remember that from playing the DS version 20 years ago, and now I'm really curious.
Yeah, I don't remember that either, but I do remember a lot of things sort of looking different in the DS version, but I have a much clearer memory of how hard it was towards the end and how bad the voice acting was.
Those are the ones that stick out.
But anyway, we're near the end of the first half of Final Fantasy IV. At the end of the tower, you encounter Golbez for the first time, and you hear his dope villain music. That's like, I don't know, like the best approximation of a giant pipe organ that the Super Nintendo can manage at the time. you encounter Golbez. Tella has a last stand and casts Meteo on him. I know it's Meteor, and Meteo is just the Japanese word for meteor, but to me, the spell is still Meteo.
It'll always be Meteo.
It's yeah. Always Meteo in our hearts.
Tella does manage to deal what seems to be a decisive blow on Golbez, but Golbez is just considered as a mere setback, and Tella dies somewhat in vain. But it does break Golbez's control over Kane.
Yeah.
So Golbez makes a tactical retreat. You manage to save Rosa just in time before either a guillotine or a giant ball slams on her, depending on what version of the game you're playing. I think the guillotine was replaced with a giant boulder for the North American Super Nintendo version.
Yep.
Because there were some, you know, censorship choices that they made or localization choices that they made way back in the day. But and then with Kane and Rosa in your party, and hopefully you remembered to go into Rosa's inventory and give her some equipment, because I think she only has prisoner clothes equipped if you don't make a change in about five steps. The party of Cecil, Kane, Rosa, Sid, and Yang fights the third elemental fiend, Barbariccia, an enemy with high evade. She can cast tornado to reduce your HP to single digits. She's a real pain in the ass, and her evade is oppressively high if you're under-leveled, which I discovered and had to go through that whole cutscene with Golbez and Tella again after some grinding to knock her out for the first time.
I think her evade is only high in her tornado form. Like, if you use Kane to jump, it'll knock her out of the spin.
Yes, but I cannot express to you, I was very low level for this. Like, my regular attacks with Cecil, Cid, and Yang just weren't hitting ever.
So she does still have high evade. It's just... Yeah,
but yeah, it's a like I would say just a medium challenge of a boss fight, but with a clearly communicated weakness to Kane's jump attack when she switches to tornado form. Black magic doesn't work very well on her, I think, but I'm not sure you have a great way of casting black magic in this part of the game.
No, you don't.
Yeah, without Tella anymore, you don't.
I don't know if like the DS version like was bugged or something, but like I was using like Kane's jump attack as you're supposed to eliminate the tornado, and still when I was attacking her, she was just like countering the hell out of me, which sometimes led to a wipe. Like, this was easily the hardest fight I had in the game so far, and I had to like grind a little bit just to be able to like survive the lightning spell, which I somehow like couldn't stop from like countering me even like outside of the tornado form. Maybe it just doesn't like completely eliminate the counter, it just reduces the odds, but felt a little cruel, to be honest.
Yeah, the other versions don't have a lightning attack.
Oh
yeah, when you said lightning attack, I was really racking my brain. It's like, did she use a lightning attack? I know I beat this game a few weeks ago.
She turns people in the original, she turns people to stone. She has the tornado spell that reduces you to low hit points, and she'll do a physical counter when you do jump.
Holy smokes, they buffed her. When you described her as like a medium difficulty fight.
And the stone spell only works after she casts it on a target three times.
Yeah, it's the slow version.
Yeah. So it's not an instant petrify. So yeah, Alex, do you have some regrets about which version of the game you're playing?
we'll touch base on this again after I've been exposed to the final dungeon.
Well, I mean, if you really want to, you probably could go back and change versions because...
And probably beat it quicker, yeah.
Maybe. Because I think we're near the end of where we are right now. This is a big turning point in the game. The next place you go is almost an entirely different world. So that seems like a pretty good stopping point. I think this has been a big nostalgia trip for all four of us. This was, if not our first RPG, like for me, a formative RPG for all of us. And it has some moments of drama and some iconic characters and scenes that have lasted for decades and decades through what Final Fantasy would become. And it's been at least 10 years, I'm not exactly sure how long, since I last played the PSP version on Vita, that I'm really having a good time with this game, even though this is, I think, at least the eighth time I've played Final Fantasy IV. But, I mean, I'm not sure if this will be the last time or not, but I'm definitely enjoying it. And I hope that you guys are enjoying it as much as I've been. Oppressive battle speed and random encounters notwithstanding, Alex.
Yeah, despite my grievances, I've still been enjoying the DS version for the new things it adds, and especially now that I understand how the augment systems work, I'm looking forward to exploring that and customizing my party members a bit for the rest of the game. So if you're looking for like a challenging version of this game to really make you sweat a bit and really, I mean, this was the first Final Fantasy with the active time battle system, right? So just like the fact that I'm trying to make all these like decisions and move selections quickly before getting absolutely bombarded by the enemy's attacks has been kind of exciting in its own ways. It's really just when I wipe to like an enemy mob that I really become a little bit upset. Otherwise, I think it's been a good experience.
And Zach, I don't know how long it's been since you last played FF4, but how has this experience been treating you? At least avoiding spoilers as much as we can through the first half.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's what I remember it. You know what I mean? Like, I've played this game so many times that, like, I knew what I was going to get. And I and it's been sort of refreshing just to be able to kind of run through it and not have to deal with all the random encounters. So yeah, I mean, I think that the moments still hit. I still played it in like 2 days or something, because when I start this game, I just can't stop. And yeah, I think that it's seminal RPG for a reason, and you know, all its flaws aside, I don't think that can be really overstated.
Yeah, total agreement. And I'm still excited to talk about this game more with you guys, but I think we're going to save that for next week. So listeners, thank you so much for listening to the first half of our Final Fantasy IV podcasts. I know we're going to talk about endgame and more character stuff, and how, you know, difficult I found the final dungeon when I was 9 or 10 years old in the next episode. And we're nearing the end of March right now, but we have all of April planned out. So after Final Fantasy IV and with Retro Encounter, we're doing one episode all about a slightly more modern Final Fantasy game. We're going to do a spoiler cast episode all about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. We've given ourselves about a full month to play through it. And then we're going to have a spoilerific episode that goes into characters and story and everything else we can possibly cram into one episode, coming in either 2 weeks or 3 weeks. I haven't quite ordered everything yet. And Zach, I know you wrote the review for Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, and I am less than 2 hours in. So I think you probably have a more fully formed opinion than I do.
I do. I was extremely high on it, and I'm extremely high on the idea that I can talk about the ending with people, because I can't talk about it with anyone right now still. So that'll be exciting.
I understand, and you'll only have to wait a few short weeks before we can do that. But also in early April, we're doing an episode all about Musou video games. That is the Warriors series of action games that is mostly by Koei Tecmo, that has recently... or I say recently, for the last 10 years or so, have had a lot of RPG elements in their games and a lot of licensed Musou games. So, it's an episode about this specific series of action games, but there's going to be Fire Emblem and Persona and Dragon Quest in that episode, also coming in early April. And in later April, we're doing two episodes on Ark the Lad, the PS1 strategy RPG that was, I think, one of the final games localized by Working Designs, tying into some of those Ludonar episodes that you recorded last year, Zach. But basically we're starting with the Super Nintendo, then skipping way ahead to the PS5, and then dialing it all the way back to the PS1 over the course of April. But listeners, if you want to talk to us about Final Fantasy IV or Final Fantasy VII Rebirth or Ark the Lad or Dragon Quest Heroes, the World Tree's Woe and the Blight Below for the PS4, you can always email us retro@rpgfan.com. Also follow RPG Fan on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, Discord, always either called RPG Fan or RPG Fan.com. Please interact with RPG Fan any way you please. RPG Fan has two other fine podcasts in the RPG Fan Podcast Network: Random Encounter every 2 weeks about randomness and what games we're playing, as well as Rhythm Encounter about rhythmness and RPG music. You can rate and review Retro, Random, and Rhythm Encounter on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or however you choose to listen to podcasts. And also, maybe the best way to interact with RPG Fan is to visit rpgfan.com, where we have reviews, features, podcasts, articles, news going up every single day. And rpgfan.com/shop is a way where you can buy RPG Fan merch, including apparel, coffee mugs, phone cases, and even a book of RPG fan reviews that's over 300 pages long and is a very impressive tome indeed. Our apparel store is hosted by TeePublic, and the book is published by Hyperplay RPG. Please buy our stuff. Please visit RPG Fan. And you can also interact with us as individuals and not as a podcast. Let's tell the fine listeners how they can talk to the fine panelists, starting with you, Alex.
You can just email me at alexfranicek@gmail.com.
Now, Lucas.
You can find me on all the social media platforms as Raefgall, RAEFGALL. And I will also say, if you are interested in this, I am also playing on my YouTube channel, which is the same name, my run of Final Fantasy IV. So that'll be going up concurrently over the next week if you want to see the second half.
That's right. And I think if you go into your YouTube archive a little bit, Lucas, there will be more than one episode of you playing the Final Fantasy IV randomizer.
Yeah, there's about 60 episodes of those, and also a full run of the PSP one and the Final Fantasy IV Ultima ROM hack.
I think that counts. But Zach, I don't think you have quite as many YouTube videos of FF4 as Lucas does.
I do not.
On your account, but how can listeners talk to you?
You can email me, ZachW@RPGFan.com, and I'm also ZachW on RPG Fan's Discord.
And listeners, I also do not have a YouTube archive full of Final Fantasy IV, but you can find me on social media in a couple places. On Instagram, Blue Sky, and RPG Fan's Discord, I am Evoker for Dogs. There aren't really any good dogs in Final Fantasy IV, are there? That's a little disappointing.
Yeah, is the flame dog in the chest?
That's true, as a flame dog, yeah. You know, maybe I should just continue playing the Pixel remasters into Final Fantasy VI later this year and see some good Final Fantasy dogs. Or just go back to playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth for a lab rat dog. Listeners, thank you. Good night.